This is the MagicWordPodcast.com.
Hello, this is Scott Wells for the MagicWordPodcast.com. This week's episode is brought to you again by the Friends of the Magic Word. Those are the ones who help support this podcast by pledging their financial support either on a one-time donation basis or monthly or now annually. For more information, just go to themagicwordpodcast.com and there you'll find out some information when you just click on the tab that says Become a Friend of the Magic Word. This week, our guest is going to be past international president of the International Brotherhood of Magicians and Gold Cup winner, Mr. Oscar Munoz. As I was introducing him at the beginning of this podcast, I kind of got tongue-tied a little bit and talking about legends of magic and everything and kind of got off on a little bit of a tangent. What I was trying to say briefly is that I believe that if you go out with the intent of trying to be important, to be famous, to be wealthy or whatever, that it may be the wrong intent for you to get into magic or into any endeavor for that matter. Is something that is just a byproduct. In other words, if you do the best you can, you will become recognized for that. And it's important to just keep on keeping on, basically. And that's exactly what Oscar has done. He's done a little bit of everything and also is humble enough to recognize that just because he's won some awards that he is not going to fall back on that and say, well, I'm not going to do these other kinds of things, that he just continues to do whatever he needs to do and going whatever direction that the wind happens to take him that seems to be the most lucrative. And as a result, I think is achieving a legendary status internationally. And I believe that is kind of what makes legends when they become the best in their field. And he, that is Oscar, is becoming one of the best known in his field then too. So there is a lot to say about this gentleman, but I'm going to let this conversation speak for itself. So please welcome my friend this week, Mr. Oscar Munoz, here on The Magic Word. Today I have with me someone who is well known to many people. A lot of times whenever I talk with my guests and feature them on the podcast, they are not necessarily always someone who are internationally known. They may be someone perhaps who's locally, regionally, or perhaps just nationally, but not necessarily internationally known. There are some people who are considered legends and others who are considered just really workers who are out there then all the time, which will eventually make them become legends. I guess that's kind of a question. How does one actually become a legend? It's, I guess, when you talk about some people who have, who we've seen in our lifetime, like Johnny Thompson, Norm Nielsen, and Fred Capps, and so many others that have been legends. But anyhow, kind of getting off the subject over here, I want to talk with someone who is a past international president of the International Brotherhood of Magicians, and also he is a winner, one of the very few winners of the Gold Cups Award that is presented by the International Brotherhood of Magicians at their annual conventions, and as well as someone who has received several other honors and awards and plaques and trophies and whatnot, and is recognized internationally, and is someone I think that is pretty much legendary in his own status. Please welcome my good friend, Oscar Munoz. Hey, Oscar.
Hey, Scott.
So good to talk with you today. And yeah, you know, I was mentioning about someone who really is more internationally known, and you have really kind of performed all over the place. I mean, not only, of course, being a past international president, meaning that it's an international organization with the IBM where people know you, but you've also been performing in a lot of those countries then as well. Because I remember when we were in Blackpool together many years ago.
Before, yes. You know, yeah, well, that was a fun convention.
That was a great time. I remember you were surprised yourself whenever that you had won the, was it the?
Children's Entertainer.
Children's Entertainer.
Children's Entertainer Award. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. I was kind of surprised because I wasn't told that I was in it until I got there.
Really? So it wasn't like something that you had applied for? You just.
Yeah, I just, I showed up and I think one of the contestants, I said, hey, I know you. And I said, well, do I know you? And he says, well, I know you because you're on the contest. Uh-huh. I said, what contest? And well, you're in the Children's Entertainer Contest. I was like, oh, that's news to me. So I went to Derek Lieber and I said, what's going on? What's this contest that I'm in. Oh yeah, I forgot to tell you about that. So I just went through the dealers, either borrowed or bought my show for the contest.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, which was, I believe, I borrowed a set of Lincoln rings, I bought some rope, and I borrowed a pair of scissors, and that was my show.
And it was like a 12-minute routine or something.
Yeah, it was. Well, they had an 8-minute. It was 8 minutes.
Okay. Well, yeah, that's a lot for in 3 minutes there, because I know how much entertainment that you pack into a short amount of time with all of your funny lines and everything. Then too.
Right. Well, it was amazing to me because it's like, I wasn't told, wasn't really prepared, but I just looked at it as just perform like you normally do. Mm-hmm. Just make sure you don't go over 8 minutes, because if you do, they ring a bell and you're disqualified.
Hmm.
I'm surprised, though, the amount of people that were there. There was like, 3,000-4,000 people?
Yeah, it was huge.
And the contestants had all this equipment, and literally my – you know how we joke about getting the broom closet for a dressing room?
Yes.
I literally got the broom closet off stage just to change, you know, like, okay, well, I guess I just crossed that one off my list.
Well, the contest was different from the rest of the presentation. That was one of the things I think probably had surprised you, because you had actually been booked and engaged as a paid performer.
Right. And so I had no knowledge of what was going on. I mean, it was like, yeah. And what was neat about it is they do it by ballot. The people vote, there's not necessarily judges per se,
mm-hmm.
but it's almost like a People's Choice Award.
Right.
And the intermission is when they got a hold of myself and they said, hey, where are you sitting? I said, see way up top? Right up there. That's where I'm sitting. He goes, well, make sure that you stand down here when they call your name.
I remember that well, because I think that you were either sitting beside me or you and Melody were right in front of me. We were up in the balcony.
Right. Yeah. And I'm going like, okay. And I didn't know if I had won first or won second or, you know, nothing, you know. So when they called me up, because the announcer said, we counted the ballots, we counted them twice to make sure that this is right. Ladies and gentlemen, the winner of, and so they called my name, and I'm like, the trophy is huge, and the money was even better.
Mm-hmm.
And the guy leans into me and says, we counted the ballots. It was after a certain amount of time, we realized you were going to win. So we didn't finish counting them all. So
I just had an overwhelming majority.
Yeah. But it was a good experience. I mean, I realized, and I have known before, that it's not really about the magic trick per se. It's about you entertaining the audience.
Right.
You know, and I learned that from watching like the great. You just at the beginning, you're talking about the, what do you call it? At the beginning of this, you were talking
Fred
about
Capps and Norm Nielsen and Johnny Thompson and all these guys. Yeah.
So I learned by watching them, you know, that it really wasn't about the trick. It's about you. I mean, I remember Billy McCone. I mean, Jesus, everything came out of his pocket, went back to his pocket, and he was done, walked away, didn't have to have a table, nothing.
Right.
You know, you can with the British accent, it was kind of entertaining in itself.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes he would mumble his words and people would still laugh. I'm going like, wow, that's entertaining.
That's true. Well, you know, you and Melody have been the convention IBM contest chairman for many years. And so do you give advice to those who are contestants?
We only give advice when asked for.
Hmm.
So when they ask us, of course, you give them advice, and I'm upfront with everything. I mean, we send them the sheet of what the judges are looking for. So we try to guide them all the way through until the end, until they finally compete and finish. I'm not one of the judges. I've never been one of the judges because I don't want people to say, oh, he, you know.
Right.
I pick people that I feel that are knowledgeable in magic and have either been on stage, performed, or in any theatrical production that would, you know,
qualify them really for being a judge.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. You've been on judges for quite some time for us.
Several times, yes. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thanks for recognizing
that. No, I mean,
appreciate that. Flattered.
You've seen a lot of magic and performed a lot of magic. So yeah. You're highly qualified in my opinion.
Well, have you, now since that was now, I'm trying to think back to that year. Was that like 2006, something like that, I think, in Blackpool, going back to that for a moment?
Jesus, I think it was.
I think it was around that time.
Yeah.
And you won the Gold Cups in what year was that?
1999,
okay. And since then, I know that Chase Curtis had won. Of course, David Williams had won, Giovanni Lavera.
Years later. Let's see if I can go down the line. Who's the first
Johnny
one?
Johnny Ace Palmer.
That's right. Johnny Ace was the first. Then it was Joe Givens. Mm-hmm. Then we got Stephen Bedwell. The guy out of Florida.
That was Giovanni Lavera.
Yeah, Giovanni. Myself and Chase Curtis.
And I think Chase was probably the last one that the Gold Cups have been awarded to, and that was at least a decade ago.
Chase. Mm-hmm. Chase had a great act for a win. It was a different act.
Well, his kind of like Giovanni's had some large things. As I recall, he was producing batteries, and eventually had like a car battery or something. And he was
That was his finality. Was a car battery. I think that the routine was Howard Hale's influence. Back in the day. But back in the day, I think magic has changed, though.
How's that?
As far as the competition, I remember when I competed for the Gold Cups, there were like 43 contestants.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it took a whole day for competition. And then you had, that was the prelims, then you had the finals.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's like directly the finals. They're your first, you got... Depending on how many people are there, you do the round robin kind of a thing, and you have, at least six times to get it right.
But there are far fewer people who are competing nowadays.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Don't know. I ask myself why. I mean, when I won the Gold Cups in 1999, it was $500. Today, mm-hmm. it's $5,000.
Wow. So there's every reason in the world that they should actually be competing for big money.
Mm-hmm. Right. And now that's a Gold Cups. And if you get first place, which, often you do, because mm-hmm. you got first place in the Gold Cups, first place is $2,500. So the potential of winning $7,500 is there.
You know, what's interesting then, too, Oscar, is I'm thinking about that. Back during that time, of course, that the IBM had probably about 1,000 registrants that would attend the conventions.
Right,
and, of course, back then we didn't really have access to the Internet and also to a lot of the social media and everything that we have today. And I'm not just referring to young people, but everybody in general, in which that we get to actually access all this information without having to wait and order a VHS from Stevens Magic Emporium or wait for a DVD. Now they're just downloadable, or you can have easy access and to chat with anybody whenever. So there are fewer and fewer people who are attending. They're not, I don't believe today people are joiners the way that they used to or travel the way they used to. But even if you would say there were about 45 people, 43 or whatever you said, for 1,000 people, that if there are 500 people, they'll say about half that, about 20. But I don't even see that many people competing anymore. And so I'm wondering why that is, because as you say that the money, the stakes have gone up, that there should certainly be more of an incentive for people to want to compete, and so I'm not clear why that there are not more people who are wanting to do it, because they're obviously wanting to be relevant. They're putting themselves out on YouTube, TikTok, and everything else as far as the social media, so people are not afraid to let the world see it. But when it comes to a live performance, do you think maybe they're just chicken? I wonder.
I don't know if it's just chicken. It's exposure. I mean, when we did it, or at least when I did it, it was I wanted to see how I compared with my peers.
Okay.
And there was exposure. You wanted to get booked in different conventions and people who did other things would go to the convention and go, hey, you would be great at this show. And then they would, introduce you to people.
Sure.
I think social media today, you really don't need the conventions. or the
I see what you're saying.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I mean,
to reach the potential bookers, you don't need to have the live performances for them to actually come and see you. You can send them a video, or they can watch your performance on social. Got it.
Yeah, it's like agents. Like, you used to have an agent that would represent you, and then he would, you know, set on his feelers and go, okay, I think you would go great in this show. I'm going to talk to this guy, and they will set it up for you and all this. Nowadays, you bypass the agent. You can go directly to the guy and say, hey, I got a show. Let me send you a video. And within seconds, it's already on his front of his computer.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly right. Yeah.
You know,
I remember so many years ago when I was being considered for a job here in Houston, and I went to talk with them. And when I did, they said, well, do you have a video? And I said, yeah, I sure do. And of course, back then, those were VHS. And they said, well, we're considering, I remember Bill Palmer was the one who was being considered, the other one, for this particular trade show. And because they said, well, we were told by Bill Palmer that you're not really a professional magician unless you actually have a video. And that was way before websites or anything. And I said, yep,
do. Wow.
So that was kind of how that, you know, I got the job, because he'd kind of said, well, you got to be professional. And he had one and I had one. But I guess anyhow,
yours was better.
Well, I'm not saying it's better. Just that was what they wanted for their particular show.
Yeah.
Because Bill Palmer as Merlin is unparalleled. I was surprised, actually, that I got it over to him. But nevertheless, I remember, again, going back to Blackpool, and also the very beginning when I was talking about people who are legends and those who may not be as well known and those who are more humble, that those who I think who become very well known are the ones who are actually going out and performing all the time, and then it's over a period of time that you actually develop this persona, not persona, but I guess this status of recognition without having to actually have a methodical way of saying, okay, I'm going to be famous because I'm going to do this, this, and this. You, on the other hand, are becoming very well known because of the things that you're doing methodically. And I'm saying this because I remember as if it was yesterday when you were saying, well, I won the Children's Award, and when I get back to the U.S., I've got Johnny's birthday party to go to.
Yeah, yeah. No, well, I mean,
you're a very humble guy.
Well, it's, I know, I think it's, thank you. But I think I'm more in, I know where I am as far as in my career. I know what I do. I'm not ashamed to say that I do birthday parties. Because that's what kept me afloat for many years. You know, yes, I do work at the conventions and I do travel overseas. I've done tours from one year I did Australia, New Zealand, Tasmania.
And then you did that tour with
when I'm done
with Murray Hatfield across Canada on the bus.
With Murray twice. Murray booked me to travel. I mean, and that was an experience. In itself.
What was that like? What are some stories? Tell me about that.
Oh, gosh. The reason why I love working with Murray is I learned from Murray. I learned how quickly he adapted to the timing and the audience that he was working with. Mm-hmm. It was not just doing the show. He was also directing the show, producing the show. I mean, it was a lot of work. Him and Teresa did a tremendous job. I respect both of them. I mean, Teresa herself did all the choreography. I don't know where they got the energy, because, I mean, I only did 13 minutes. And I was like, at the end of the show, I was like, woo, you know. But they, you know, not only when we were done, I packed up my 13 minutes within 30 minutes. They were still packing up their stuff and, you know, getting the stuff, the illusions back in the box. I mean, they had a crew. But, I mean, it was a tremendous learning experience for me watching Murray and Teresa do what they do. Phenomenal.
Who else was on the tour when...
When I did it, the first time, it was Romani, Paul, and then it was, myself, Paul Romani, and Dan Sperry was on the show.
Now, again, this was way before The Illusionist, too.
Right. Yeah. Right. Right. And then the second time it was the handkerchief guy, Sean Begonia.
Oh, Sean Begonia. Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Sean Begonia, Chipper Lowell. Myself. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Chipper Lowell and myself were on.
Yeah, I would think that would be completely different kind of environment from what you were used to being in South Texas and then going to someplace in Canada where it's freezing cold and snow.
Yeah. There was a place called Regina. I'll never forget this. The city was Regina, Canada. And it snowed that night. And we were on the bus all night long to get to Regina. And so we get to the hotel, and literally by I just had my small suitcase, my purple costume, zoot suit bag, and from the bus to the front door, my fingers turned purple.
Just that quick. Wow.
It was that cold. Yeah, it was that cold. And I'm going like, nobody's going to come out and watch a show. And it was like when we got to the theater, it was packed. We got to the theater, we set up and all that, and I'm like, oh, there's no way people are going to come out to watch the show. Mm-hmm. It's freaking cold out here. And we got there, we set up and all, and they started the show, and when I walked out, I go, oh, my God.
They're used to that kind of weather.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
No big deal.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. They to me, it was like from South Texas, going from 99, in the heat to going to, two below zero. I mean, yeah, no. It was amazing. But people were, I had a great time working for Murray.
Yeah, yeah.
But I was going to say is that once I got off that tour, it's like working the castle. Once you got off the castle, it was like that literally that afternoon when I flew back, I had a birthday show outside in somebody's car garage. And I laugh at that. I even took a picture of it because it's just, the night before you were performing to all these, I would say well-off people, because it takes pretty penny to go to the Magic Castle and spend a good dinner and all that, to working for people who are excited that you're there.
Sure.
So I'll always say if it wasn't for the birthday parties, I wouldn't be where I am, because that you're home, you're tuning in on your craft.
Yes.
It's like I talked to Mike Camera. Mike Camera started doing birthday parties.
He was in Chicago, you mean, before he moved to Vegas?
Mm-hmm. Before he moved to Vegas, he was doing birthday parties.
I think we all have. I did hundreds of them.
Yeah, but you home in on your material.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. How to talk to the adults as well as children. And you can have those one-liners with the adults. It goes over the children's heads.
Right.
And you can home in. I mean, I was working RV parks at the age of 15.
RV parks, really? In South Texas?
South Texas, yeah. Yeah. They used to call it the love offering. It's when they pass buckets.
Okay. And that was the next thing to street performing, huh?
Yeah, but it's almost a captured audience. Mm-hmm. You know, and you can kind of say those lines before they walked out the door without dropping anything in the bucket,
Yeah.
So, but you learn. I mean, I learned watching, George Sands.
Sure.
I used to help George Sands unload his car, and for every time I would help him unload, he would teach me a trick. He wouldn't pay me. He would teach me a trick that was worth more than getting paid.
Oh boy.
For me.
Yeah.
And you watch his timing, and you watch how he delivered his lines, and I guess that's our way. That was our internet. Yeah, because you would seek out the performers. You would seek out a mentor.
When you say you followed George Sands, I mean, were you like an assistant and follow him around?
No, or was it not at all. I was just helping him unload.
For one particular show?
For his show, yeah.
Okay.
Just whatever he had and stuff. He didn't have much because he did ropes and stuff. But it was just wanting to hang out with somebody that knew more than you did.
Sure. Well, I remember the story you've talked about before where that you had seen somebody come to your school and do the Miser's Dream, and you thought, that's what I want to be.
Yeah. Oh, gosh, yeah.
He's making money from nothing.
By the way, I had forgotten his name, and at a TAOM, he ran up to me and said, I'm that guy. And I said, are you really? He goes, yeah. And, I don't know where I left. He gave me a poster of him, and it had the names of the schools that he was performing down south, and that was him.
Hmm.
He did.
And so that was what inspired you.
What inspired me to get in magic?
Yeah.
Well, the first connection of me getting into magic was the David Copperfield shows. You know,
on television, yeah.
On mm-hmm. television, yeah. I grew up watching him. Then my grandmother got sick one year, and she had to be put in the hospital. And in McAllen, Texas, there was only one magic shop, and it was Viking Magic.
Sure, George Robinson.
And which was right across the street, a couple of blocks down from the hospital. Now, I couldn't go up because I was too young to go up. And so they would leave me sitting down at the bottom. And, you know, I was old enough to understand that I need, you know, how to cross the street and stuff. And I walked into George Robinson's magic shop. And that's when I first saw the first, like, magic trick, per se. And they're like, oh, my God, this is so awesome.
Yeah.
But the seed was planted by that performer at the school.
Was that Sam Gaynor?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, my God. That was him. How yes. the hell you know him?
Well, he was my CPA for many years.
Really?
Yeah. He had a partnership with some other CPAs, and he had the fourth largest CPA partnership in Houston, and he has a degree not only in accounting but then also in law, and he'd worked
wow.
with the IRS and everything as well. But because he has a performer's background, because he was a full-time performer, he understands about tax law as it relates to magicians in particular. And there are several of us who use him then as his our CPA. Yeah,
what?
But then also he was a unicyclist. He also worked
yes
for a
yes,
while.
Yes.
Apparently, this is kind of an interesting story about Sam, that he had worked at the San Francisco Steakhouse. You remember they used to have a girl in the red velvet
yeah.
swing and everything?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, when he was going to school at the University of Texas, that he also plays a piano. He is a, you know, has a ragtime piano.
Wow.
And he actually had produced these record albums. And he said, I was making more money from royalties. In particular, he was big in Japan, I guess. They loved his records. And so he said, I was making more money in a year just from the record albums than my father was earning. And
wow.
I mentioned the old San Francisco, and he had a couple of different releases of his piano playing, but then also he ended up marrying the girl who was on the red velvet swing. His first wife was Norma was the one later, but anyhow, that was his first wife. But
wow.
he is really a Renaissance man. He takes these photos,
yes.
travels around the world. He's got these wonderful calendars, and I'm saying he's a wonderful craftsman, woodworker, magician,
wow.
unicyclist, and all that. But what I'm saying is a good photographer. I mean, his photographs actually are in museums, and they go on tour because they're just so wonderful. So yeah, I mean, I can understand it because I remember him telling me that also. He said, I was the one, I think I inspired Oscar. But I remember
yeah.
some years later, then you went to the Magic Island because you were telling me that you had sat in and saw me probably do a close-up show, and I'm sure you were
right.
thinking, well, he can do that. I'm better than that. I can
right.
perform. No, I don't know. But yeah. but you were seeing other magicians coming into the Magic Island and
right.
a variety of people back then, too.
Yeah, no, there was a the Magic Island thing, talking about sending a video. I mean, I had to send a video to Scott. And
mm-hmm.
you know, I got didn't get a response. And, you know, I was a nobody. Heck, I'm still a nobody. So
no, you're not. You are somebody.
Then I went to see a show at Magic Island. I was traveling through doing a school show.
Uh-huh.
And so I stopped in and I, you know, obviously you had to be dressed and all that. So I dressed with my suit on and all. And Scott asked me, we were in line waiting to get into the theater. And Scott says, are you a magician? And I said, oh, yes, yes, I am. And he goes, why don't you send me a video? And I said, I did. You haven't responded. And so I guess that day or that night or whenever, I got a call back and he gave me a chance.
That's
and
great.
That's another learning experience, you know,
yeah.
With working for Scott.
Yeah, Scott Hollingsworth has helped so many people, and his name has gone far and wide also, not just being an excellent magician, but also as a good director and someone who has helped produce other
oh, definitely.
Shows. Yeah, where
yeah.
that he has helped so many of us in saying, you know, you need to stand right here or to eliminate this line or add this or, you know,
right.
pause here or whatever. I mean, he is, that's why I think magicians, for the most part, don't have that opportunity in many places nowadays to go out and perform because you're just doing these one-off venues, whether it's a banquet, a birthday birthday party or your trade show, whatever it is, you don't have someone who is in a theater night after night and saying, hey, you know, you need to trim this, do that, stand over here, your blocking should change, and maybe put your props there. And that was the advantage, certainly, of having the shows at Magic Island night after night, just much like the Magic Castle. And there again, you know, Jack Goldfinger is a great director from the standpoint saying, hey, I suggest you might want to tighten this up or do that. He's given me several suggestions, too.
Yeah, I was always I'm always afraid when I work for Jack. Jack comes in to see your first set,
right?
So he sees his first set, and then he'll give you what we call the Jack Goldfingerisms or the Jackisms, you know.
Jack's gems.
Yes. And it was like, you know, there was one trick that I wanted to debut, and I ran it by him, and he goes, "When in doubt, leave it out."
That's what Walter Blaney always told me.
Yeah, and it's like, okay, yeah. Because the idea, here was the idea, I'll share it with you. So I wanted to do the cards across.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it's a great trick by in itself, but I wanted to make it funny. So I was going to do the cards across the wall, right? Being Latino, I was going to make fun of this wall thing,
Mexican,
you know?
U.S. wall, yeah, border wall.
Mm-hmm. Right, the border wall, right? And using Mexican cards, I don't know if you ever seen those, what they call, we call it chalupa, it's a Mexican bingo, right?
It's about the size of a jumbo card, kind of, or a little bit smaller than that, actually, between a
that's a bingo card, and then you have the cards, and then the ones that you turn over, it's like, instead of numbers, it's pictures.
Yeah, I remember it had like chickens and things on there?
Yeah. Okay. So that's what the idea was, is I'm going to take these cards, and they're going to go across the wall. You know, don't worry, we'll pay for the wall. So I had all those jokes involved with it, and he laughed. He goes, "Great, but if you're indicting yourself, leave it out." So I left it out. It's like, I guess he's right. I don't want to offend any of my audience. And though I knew it was gonna be funny, but was it funny because I was thinking it funny? I think it's funny myself, but would my audience think it's funny? And do you know what's going on in the country right now? I just leave it alone. I said, no, let's just go, you know, entertain.
Right. Yeah, there should be some doubt that we should always kind of hesitate before we not only perform something, but also before we say something, from the standpoint that you don't want to offend anyone. And that's something that I constantly find just beyond my comprehension whenever I see professionals in particular, or those who are wanting to get jobs, who are posting on social media certain things that are their religious or political beliefs, one way or the other, because there's always going to be somebody on the other side, regardless of whatever your opinion is. I like red, well, I like yellow, you know, whatever it is.
Right.
You know, so you have to be, I think, super cautious. That's why I think people post pictures of food, you know, because, you know.
I don't like that. I don't like spaghetti and meatballs. Yeah, no, it's getting harder, Scott, I think, as an entertainer to be able to entertain without offending.
Because it's harder to laugh at yourself.
The entertainer in itself is not trying to offend anybody, but the person that you're entertaining may take it offense. And that's the problem, is that, you know, comedy, for me, comedy arises from such things as this.
Yes.
You know, comics back then used to make fun of whatever as far as race, color, and we took it as comedy.
From their ethnicity, basically.
Yeah, and where I took my ethnicity and make fun of myself. Mm-hmm. And when I do that, when I make fun of myself, I even get people who are Latinos who say, no, you're making fun of me. I was like, what? You know, no, I'm making fun of me. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're like me and you feel that way, I'm sorry, but I'm making fun of me, you know, and I learned that from doing a show at a school that I used to do this commercial break. And I put it in just so because I needed to drink some water, and I would do a commercial break where I just drink water, make the glass float. But in there, I'm making characters.
Yeah.
Right. So toma agua, por favor. You know, drink guagua. And then I put on some, you know, those bottle glasses, those comic bottle glasses.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And I
very
do
thick.
Some gibberish sounding Japanese kind of a line.
Mm-hmm.
And after the show, the lady who herself was Japanese, came up to me and kind of let me have it. That made her feel bad.
Wow.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And like, there was no intent to make anybody feel bad.
Of course.
You know, and I took it out. That day, I took it out and said, if I'm going to make somebody feel bad because of this, I took it out. You know?
Well, I've heard that said about other professional comedians who are not magicians, just full-time comedians. I mean, particularly that Jerry Seinfeld has famously said that he really can't work college campuses anymore because of the political correctness.
Right. Yeah.
The things
Of, yeah. We get a whole list. Like, I work for some of the college circuits around the United States, and we get a list of don't talk about this, don't say, you know, don't be negative on this, don't, you know, and so you're like, okay, we'll throw that one out. We throw this one out. But then you learn to make it, I mean, make it better.
Right,
I guess eliminating that cheap line. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
That you know it was going to get fun. You know you're going to get laughs, but it's a cheap line.
Right.
And so you find something that's equally as funny and does not offend. And it only makes you better as an entertainer. So I understand. I mean, it's hard. Don't get me wrong. It's hard because you'd never thought about that. When I was younger, I never thought about that kind of stuff.
And I think it's important that you kind of go through and look at what you're saying in your lines and also update that as regularly as you can. I recently had a guest on an episode that was talking about his new book. Ryan Kane had written this book called Out of Stock, in which he was talking about taking all the stock lines. And a friend of mine, a friend of the Magic Word, Steve Sabo, had posted a comment about that, of saying that it seems that it was that there's nothing wrong with some of these lines. And then Paul Draper came and had posted a comment to the contrary of saying, well, that's fine, but depending upon who your audiences are, if you're going to be doing this in a full-time professional manner, that you need to have something that's going to be fresh and original, not something that's going to be expected.
Well, it's like that. I've heard this story about a magician using some stock lines. You know that one about stick out your clean hand?
Yes.
You know, I said clean one?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Well, there was that story running around that a magician asked the kid, stick out your clean hand.
Right.
Kid sticks out his clean hand. Mm-hmm. No, the other one, and he didn't have the other hand.
Didn't have a hand.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, we got to be aware of those situations as an entertainer, regardless if it's magic or comedy or, you know, a stand-up kind of worker.
Well, beyond that, I think that you have to be conscious of today's grammar, lingo, whatever, you know.
Right.
And I say that because, there again, going back to Paul Draper, it seems like that he was saying that I remember – you had a problem, I think, at a college one time in which that there was some line that was used and they later didn't like it because that was a euphemism that young people use for something that is a vulgar act, apparently, unbeknownst to him. And to me, it's like, what? I never heard that being used.
Right,
Yeah. So you have to kind of be aware and be up on
modern lingo.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. It's like the word, you know, you're fat. When the kid said, man, dude, you're fat.
Mm-hmm.
And I go like, okay, yes, I am fat. And then somebody explains to me later that meant you're good.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I like, what happened to the word good?
Yeah, it's kind of like, that's bad, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like Michael Jackson, you know?
Right, yeah. But it's like, for me, it's like, why did I just say you're good?
Yeah, like, yeah.
You know, whatever happened to you're good, then you're fat. I know I'm fat. You know, it's like,
that, just real quickly on health, something that I remember going back to Blackpool for just a minute, that we were having breakfast one morning and you were coming in a little bit late and you said you had indigestion or something, and then you went home, found out you had like a heart issue and started losing some weight and everything. So I think that's important that you pay attention to what your body's telling you then also.
Yeah. Yeah. To lose weight. I had lost that weight. I think I lost 80 pounds in 8 months.
Wow.
Yeah. And, you know, as you get older, you know, you realize the high blood pressure and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes it's just genetics, you know.
That's true.
You have to pay attention to what your body is saying to you. You know, when you overwork yourself and you're tired and, you know, you need to
recognize that.
Yeah, you need to, you know, recognize that. And, I mean, be proactive. You know, go get I go every 6 months to a cardiologist.
Mm-hmm.
Just to, you know, as you get older, I'm 56,
mm-hmm.
you know, you want to make sure everything is going well.
Sure.
For my friends out there who just turned 50, please go get yourself a colonoscopy. Not do it yourself. Go to
good
a
advice.
Doctor.
Good advice. You know? Good advice. Yep.
Yeah, because, I mean, when I went, that was my 50th birthday present to myself.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we lost a lot of our friends in magic through because they didn't go through to do a colonoscopy.
That's
you
true.
Know? And I went in and they found 3 polyps. So they removed them. Thank God there was nothing there. Now, every 3 years, I go in just for a checkup.
Yeah.
You know, this last one was, they didn't find any. So he said, see you in 3 years.
That's great news. Yeah, but I think that's important, that you go in for regular checkups. And so I'm just pointing that out of saying that's something that we all, as we're getting older, and those who are listening who are older, those who are younger saying, hey, I'm going to live forever, that doesn't apply to me. Well, eventually it will, you know. So just something
right,
to keep
right,
in mind.
Right, right, yeah.
Because thinking of some of those people, you know, we've had a lot of people who have recently passed. You know, I mentioned, Norm Nielsen, of course, and Johnny Thompson from last year. But then of late, it just seems like, we had a bunch, with, of course, Roy Horn and Brad Jacobs, who is a friend that was Sam,
right.
a past president.
Right.
Louis Langa, Nick Ruggiero, who used to be the Collector's Workshop. Mr. Electric, of course, just recently. And then now we have Ramon Galindo. And Ramon, it was someone who was one of the first guys who did parakeet magic and was a tailor in San Antonio.
Gosh, yeah.
A good friend of both of us.
I'll tell you a quick story about Ramon. He's a fellow Texan. Was in World War II and was also a tailor. I remember getting up. The first time I met him was at TAOM. And I saw him carrying around the video camera, videotaping all the acts.
Yep.
And I asked him for a videotape of my act. And he was kind and gave me a copy. It was, I didn't know that he was a tailor until somebody told me, oh, yeah, he's a tailor. And it's like, and he makes all these parakeet holders. And in my close-up contest act for the Gold Cups, I used to appear a parakeet. And so I contacted him because I needed his advice on how to get a parakeet on the plane.
Oh.
And so he made me my first parakeet holders to smuggle the parakeets on the plane. That's before the
metal detectors.
Yeah, metal detectors, X-ray machines.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I would take 2 parakeets and it would be strapped to my leg. And he made me my first parakeet holders. Because they would have to charge you extra to carry a pet. What do you call it? A pet carrier?
Yeah, pet carrier. Right.
Yeah, almost
right.
As much as it was buying this extra seat.
Well, Ramon has done so much for so many and is well known throughout much of the community, and it's amazing.
Oh,
he lived for 99 years.
I know. Mm-hmm. Listen, if I'm making 99, I'm blessed. I'll tell you what. And he was in his, he still talked magic, still tried to do the back palming stuff, and, I give him, as president, I give him a citation.
Mm-hmm. Well, just as Mr. Electric then as well, who had turned 95 before that he had passed and was just as passionate, I think, up until the last moment. Magic, every time you talked about magic, it was always, he referred to the goddess of magic, of someone. I was watching a recent video of him when he was talking at Magic Live and saying that sometimes Carol, his wife and assistant, wasn't sure whether that he loved her or the goddess of magic more.
Oh, wow. Yeah. No, I remember talking to Mr. Electric at the castle. I used to just take off my coat and toss it off stage.
Uh-huh.
And he took the time. Now, he didn't have to do this. He took the time to go to my dressing room and said, can I give you an advice? And I was like, oh, my God, is Mr. Electric going to talk to me? I said, yes, sir. Yes, I would love some advice. And he said, when you take off your coat, treat it as if it was your baby.
Huh.
Instead of tossing it on stage, you would gently fold it over a chair. And that made a whole difference.
Hmm.
It was a simple thing like that made a difference in the act. I didn't fold it over a chair. I had a coat stand and a hanger.
Right.
And so the following day, I changed it.
So you kind of treat your props and your clothing with some bit of
respect.
Reverence. And respect. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. yeah, 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 yeah.
You know, that reminds me of something years ago Terry Seabrook had told me. I was telling him about a sale that the local tuxedo place was having. It's a warehouse sale annually. I said, you can go down. When he was working the Magic Island here in Houston, I said, hey, they're having the sale. And go down and sale, you know, they're used tuxedos, but they're freshly. They probably haven't worn but a half dozen times. You get new shirts, et cetera. You can get the whole set, you know, for this. And he said, I'm not interested because that, you know, I buy my suits at Savile Row in London, and it's just the top of the top. And I said, well, when you're on stage and you got the lights and everything, black is black, and I don't understand. He said, it's how you feel in that suit. Because if you look good, you feel good, and if you feel good, you're going to do a great show.
Right.
It's like, huh, that's good advice.
And believe it or not, people do look at things like that.
Mm-hmm.
My zoot suits were $1,000 a piece.
No kidding.
Wow. And there were, and I had three of them as I lost weight.
Yeah, well, they appeared to be well tailored.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, they were made by a lady in Vegas that was a seamstress for Siegfried and Roy.
Hmm.
Yeah, and she made my zoot suits and all the other coats that I had. But people notice a difference, you know. It's like if you wear, I notice when somebody's lying to me, where like, oh yeah, I travel and I do this and I do that and we're about to go on show and he tells me all this stuff and you look down and you look at their shoes.
Mm, good point.
You know, and you're like, no, I don't think so. Yeah. When you get your shoes at Target, you know.
Yeah.
Like, you know who I look at?
Who's that?
Michael Finney.
Yeah.
And Michael Finney dresses.
He's impeccably dressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's dressed.
Very fashionable.
Nice. Yeah, very, very. I mean, every time he comes out, he has a different coat.
Mm-hmm.
As if he's emceeing, he has a different pair of shoes. He's dressed to kill, you know, and very impressive, you know. And I think, wow, you know, as I get older, not that Michael is getting like just dresses phenomenally.
Yes.
And we went when I was at the castle. He took me down where he buys his shirt. And that guy spends time looking at the proper, you know, shirt. Does it feel good? Does it look good on me? And he'll try four or five different shirts before he goes, nah, let me walk down the other street, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. But yes, dress is important.
And kind of a related note in talking about shoes, a couple different things. I remember there was someone who I was reading some lecture notes and they said that his father had given him advice saying, if you have $100, you should spend $99 on a good pair of shoes and the other dollar on food.
Mm-hmm.
Because that should look good. It's something that you're going to be wearing that feels good. Particularly, like if you're going to be on your feet for a long time, if you're strolling, you're in a restaurant, or particularly if you're a trade show magician and you're on your feet for a number of hours, then you need to have something that is going to look good and it's going to feel good on your feet and kind of massage your feet then too. Second of all, I remember Tony Brooke or Anthony Darkstone, who he suggests that you take a magic marker before the show and you color in like the top of the soles of your shoes black. So when you're walking out, that people are not seeing the worn part of your shoes. So it looks like that
the fresh new.
It's more like it's fresh and new because there are people who are looking up at you because the toes of your shoes might be curled up a little bit so that the fronts of those soles underneath there should be dark also.
Right.
So he said, just kind of color that in. I thought that's a nice little tip.
Yeah, no, it is. I was just thinking about that. That's true. That's true. I mean, these are the things that you'll never learn on the internet.
That's a very good point. It's just through talking with pros and kind of getting tips from people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'll never. I mean, that's the problem with these kids nowadays. Like today, I saw a trick advertised, and I won't say who was advertising it, but it's advertising a vanishing ring. You have a ring in your hand. You put your other hand on top. Your hand it's sort of slightly parallel to the ground. Is it parallel? Vertical to the ground.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay. And then you put your hand in front of it, and the ring vanishes. I saw the video.
Okay.
And it directly went back to one of the famous entertainers, inventors here in Texas. John Cornelius. And we all know that he invented the, what's it called, Flickle Nickel?
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Exactly what I saw. I said, wait a minute. And the title was brand new vanishing whatever ring in your hand. I'm going like,
oh, that's funny.
No. And I even wrote on it and I said, I think John Cornelius needs, someone needs to credit John Cornelius.
Yeah, but if this guy is vanishing a ring instead of a nickel, then it's different.
Quite different.
Right. It's kind of a quick funny story about that shortly after Doug Henning had opened his first magic special with that nickel.
Oh,
vanish,
yeah. Yeah.
That was phenomenal to think here's an illusionist. He's opening with this something small, just looking at his hand, and it was phenomenal. But I remember what I had gone down to San Antonio, and I looked up John. I called him, went to his house, and actually bought a fickle nickel from him. And he gave me kind of a personal tutorial on how to do that. And that's when I first met him and got to spend some time with him there in his house. And he was showing me some card tricks and an impromptu card rise, and still fooled me to this day. Anyhow.
Was that with the ball?
It may have been. He didn't teach it to me. He just showed it and it's like, what?
Oh, okay.
Probably now that I think about that, it could have been how he did that. Yes. Certainly a lot of good magicians in Texas. What's one of your favorite venues? You mentioned like different places around the world where you worked on different stages, and whether you're working like in school shows or kids' garages, you know, at the Magic Castle or up in Canada or opera houses.
There were so many that every venue that I have worked in has its own special place in my heart. Mm-hmm. Obviously, the Castle was for me was a place where I wanted to be, because I remember my first experience being at the Castle. You know, I was straight out of boot camp. Instead of buying a ticket to go home, I bought a ticket on a bus to go to Hollywood, California, to get in to watch the show. I couldn't because I wasn't a member, but Shamada was the one that got me in.
Hmm.
Yeah, to see the shows. Magic Castle will always have a place in my heart, because that's, you know, when you reach there, you know, you reach the top.
Right.
But there was also really cool places that I worked. Magic Island, you know, I got there close to the end of it was still in its heyday, but it was like going down from there.
Right.
But I had the opportunity to work there and refine my act for adults.
But some of the most fun time, I think, also at the Magic Island was sitting around at dinner with the performers.
Right.
Before the shows.
With Scotto, mm-hmm. Yeah, there it is, at his booth.
Yeah.
And you can have dinner with him, and we talk about the show and talk about other performers and stuff. That was a good place to work. Mm-hmm. Overseas, gosh, when you worked on that stage of Blackpool, to see that many people in front of you was amazing.
That was the Winter Garden, I think, right?
Yeah, the Winter Garden, mm-hmm. yes. And the week before, Madonna had just played there.
Yeah,
and I've been there at least three times performing. Yeah.
I was performing in Bristol for the Bristol Day of Magic one time, and when they put me up at the hotel, they said, well, you're staying in the Oscar Munoz suite.
Oh, are you serious?
I'm absolutely serious. That's what they told me.
Oh, my God. Really?
I thought, huh, I wonder what makes that special. Well, he was so good. We just remember that's where he stayed.
That's funny. That is funny. Bristol? Oh, gosh. I worked there with Chef Hobson.
Oh, how fun.
And he asked me to be on one of his bits that he wanted me to do.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, so he comes out in his dress of balls. It's just like a dress that he's wearing that has all these balls glued to it.
Okay.
And it's late night.
You mean like
show.
Manipulation balls kind of thing?
No, yeah, just sponge balls, I think they were.
Oh, sponge balls. Okay.
It's all over it was a dress that was made. And I'm thinking, I said, okay, what do you want me to say? He goes, no, just introduce me. I'll come out and just ad lib.
Okay.
I said, okay. And I took, you know,
improvisation classes.
Yeah, right. So I said, okay, cool. He comes up there, and it was late night, and there are these, their ages were, a lot of, you look across, it was white, right?
Yeah.
It was older crowd, and they weren't getting the jokes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I see it in his eyes that he's going to bail. I'm like, oh, you're not going to leave me here, bitch. And it was so funny because he would throw me the lines, yeah, and I'd throw back some lines at him, and nobody was laughing but us. And he goes, at the end, he goes, I'm leaving. I owe you a drink. And he walks off stage. And like, thanks, well, ladies and gentlemen, you know.
Yeah, leaving you hanging.
Yeah, but that was a fun place. Bristol, yeah, was a, that's where I met I met Danny Haney.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Bristol. So,
and he was performing there, or was he a dealer?
You know, he was performing.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Awesome, man. Talking about another... I mean, I've never met somebody that has been rude or mean in magic.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody that I've met has been awesome. You know, I've not heard of anybody that, you know... I've just been lucky that I've met so many wonderful people in magic,
mm-hmm,
that I respect and admire. I mean, you're one of them. I remember watching you when I would go at the Magic Castle, Magic Island, I'm sorry, and watch you perform. And so debonair looking, you know, I was like, damn, I wish I had hair.
Well, thank you.
You know, even now with that beard and the white hair, you look very distinguished, you know.
I just had a fraternity brother of mine, Tom Blomquist, who had contacted me and kind of gave me a similar compliment. I don't get these very often, so I take them like I get them. And he had said, you know, you've really grown into yourself. You know, you have this character, this persona now with your hair and your beard and everything. And
right.
I remember sitting at breakfast with Stan Allen one time, and just as we did, he said, you know, that beard really looks good on you. And so I thought, yeah, well, thank you.
It does.
So,
yeah. Yeah, that's the only thing I let it grow once in a while, but I look older. You seem to look younger with yours. You know.
Thank you. Well, thank you for stroking me. I appreciate that also.
No, I mean, to me, it's like, no, like I let mine grow. Like, nah, you're looking older. It's like, well, I'm getting older.
some people, it doesn't look quite the same.
Right.
Well, listen, as we start to wrap up over here, that, as you know, I've had you on several times, really never a chance to sit down and chat for a proper hour like we've done here now. I mean, usually it's just at a convention and get a few snippets here and there about your opinions on the convention and what's been going on, et cetera, et cetera. And so much stuff that you've shared here has been really great, and I appreciate that then as well. So what is your magic word? What is your phrase that you live by?
Oh gosh, I just try to make it through the day. Being a performer, I don't know how many people are listening out there, but being as a performer, some of us go through what we call kind of a depression mode.
Mm-hmm.
I love getting on stage. I love performing, whether it be a birthday party, where it be performing on a big stage or small stages. I just love performing. And when somebody tells you you can't do it right now, it kind of takes the wind off you,
mm-hmm,
you know. And recently, my mantra is just make it through the day.
Just make it through the end of the day.
Yeah, make it through the day. Because, it's kind of depressing that we can't perform.
Kind of live for another day.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of a thing, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean... It's kind of, you have to reevaluate yourself and change now the way you perform, how you interact with people. It's sort of like somebody taking away your favorite toy.
Mm-hmm.
You can't play with that anymore.
Yeah.
You know, so just make it through the day.
I understand.
Yeah,
well, you've been making it pretty well, and it's always good to chat with you. So thank you very much, Oscar. I appreciate it.
Thank you. No, thank you for thinking of me, and I hope to see you real soon somewhere down the road.
I know we will. Looking forward to that.
All right, sir.
So until next time, that was my buddy, Oscar Munoz. This is Scotty out. Well, there was some valuable advice. Thank you very much. I appreciate your sharing many of those professional tips with us there on this week's podcast. That was really great. And speaking of professional tips, during our conversation, I had mentioned a set of lecture notes that I was recommending, and the name of the person who wrote them and is selling them slipped my mind, but I remembered later it was Eric Henning, and I highly recommend that. He and I spoke on actually a two-part podcast back in 2014. It's one of those things that's worth going back and listening to again, because he is the financial wizard. He as someone who knows a lot about taxes and how they relate to magicians, but also as a professional performer, that he has a lot of really great ideas. And his lecture notes that are called TIPS, T-I-P-S in capital, Real World Ideas from a Working Magician, is available through his website that's called thewand.net. That's T-H-E-W-A-N-D, as in David, .net. And Eric Henning, again, has some fabulous suggestions there in the set of lecture notes, which I'd recommend. Well, listen, this has been a lovely time, and thank you guys again for joining us this week, as you do every week. We appreciate your support by coming and listening to us. If you want to help out, you can by just going to the iTunes store. If you can help us by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving some nice comments, that helps our podcast a lot. At the bottom of every one of our podcast blogs on themagicwordpodcast.com, there is a graphic that has Amazon in it saying we're an affiliate. If you just click on that, if you're going to be buying something from Amazon, and who isn't, just click on that, and if you purchase something, a few cents comes back to us as an affiliate. So thank you very much. And if you have not yet subscribed to the Pod Letter, be sure to do that. So this way that you keep up to date on who is on from week to week and who's coming up next week and some suggestions from the archives. So until next week, stay well, get booked, and remember to be flexible so that you can make it through the day. This is Scotty out.